Stay informed ahead of the elections.
Stay on 702 and Cape Talk.
And I want to introduce you to Jeremy Vieri in a few moments' time, but I'd love to take your calls as we have this conversation. And as I said, the lines are now open on 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. Major General Jeremy Vieri is my guest. He's the author of memoir, Into Dark Water, or a police memoir. And he joins me now on the line. Jeremy, Jeremy, good evening to you, sir. Are you well?
Hi, good evening, Aubrey. Are you well? Good evening to the listeners, too.
I'm very well. Jeremy Funny Elsies. I love that. I absolutely love that.
The first book before as well.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me, Jeremy, if you don't mind me calling you Jeremy, or would you prefer me calling you Major General?
No, call me Jeremy.
Anyway, when you write, you seem to write with a very interesting, an interesting "I don't care" attitude. I don't know if that makes sense. It's like you are very boldly telling your story without caring about what dissenting opinions may have to say, in the best sense of what I'm trying to say. But there's an attitude in your writing that gives me the sense that you are telling your story and not too worried about what other people may have to say about what you say.
Yeah, that is one way of describing it. But, you know, the memoir form itself as a particular form of writing is not a factual or biographical account of a life.
Yeah.
But it takes a very specific period or theme in a particular life, in this case, policing, my interaction with policing. And it reflects more on that, more in terms of the personal effects it has on the person who lives that through that particular period or what they're writing about. It's not exactly an objective treatise like an academic reflection on the period would be, but it's basically policing through my eyes during the time I was there. So it requires a kind of honesty and a kind of reflective sense about what did I bring to policing personally, how did it affect me and how it shaped me, and how the shadows within myself and the shadows within policing that comes with the past intersected to make up this character called Jeremy Vieri, Major General Vieri, the police officer. And that is essentially why I think the tone needs to be a little bit more honest and a lot more reflective of how you feel, and must be clear in if your opinion is wrong or right, it must be clearly stated. So your mistakes must be clearly acknowledged.
Yep. No. I hear that.
Yes. So that's essentially would speak to what you raised now.
Yeah. And the reason why I start with that, Jeremy, is because of the frankness of your writings, not only in this memoir, but also in your blogs. I mean, part of the reason why I suppose you've left the police service is because of the acrimony that has arisen as a result of some of the stuff that you've written in your Facebook blogs that has put you, I suppose, at loggerheads with some of your senior colleagues. I mean, I think there's a part in one of your blogs where you refer to the term "murala," and it is very much a characteristic of the way that you write, that very brutal honesty about the way you see things that might make other people a little uncomfortable?
Well, I fought for a democracy. I fought in controversies, and one of the principles enshrined later in our constitution was freedom of speech, the right to criticize no matter who is, but particularly to speak truth to power. In a way, as any cadre from the environment that past I came from should and ought to do that, and in a principled fashion. So yes, but when it comes to the blogs you refer to, or the Facebook posts, you know, particularly the controversy around the term Murala, let me clarify firstly, Kaaps, Afrikaaps, the parent of standard Afrikaans,
yeah,
that later was expropriated from us by Afrikaners. In that particular language, Moor is not vulgar. And I understand to people who are not used to hearing it, who not having grown up in the environment I grew up, they would, in the way they interpret it, see it in a particular way, but that is, I have the right to express myself in the way I should in my indigenous tongue, and well, that is the form in which it came in. And it was used, as I was saying, to encourage a colleague of mine, General Jacobs, to win in his particular court battle that he had in the labor matter. And it was the most sharpest expression of my support for him. But like I said, that is how it might sound to those who haven't grown up on the Cape Flats with me. But to me, it's familiar to my home language.
It's interesting that the same sort of term was used by the former Minister of Sports, now Minister of Transport, Minister Fikile Mbalula, when he was encouraging the Springboks. I mean, you remember that time when he was speaking to the nation here in Johannesburg, and one of the things he did say is Murala, in the parlance of Afrikaaps. And nobody took the same kind of umbrage that they have with you, yeah?
Yeah, they will have to explain why they chose to, why the police, they chose to see it in a particular way, in a very narrow way that vulgarizes my mother tongue.
So let's talk a little bit about this brutally honest guy, Jeremy Viery, who has had an illustrious career in the police service, but is also a revolutionary, a former MK operative, former teacher, I'm told, a philosopher, a writer, somebody who holds the principle of freedom of speech very, very dearly, who joins the South African Police Service. An organization that demands, some may argue, for its ability to operate a certain level of conformity, a certain level of uniformity. Why did you land up there, Jeremy? Why did you land up in the police service? You could have gone into the army. You could have gone into politics, where you could have then used your prowess as a writer, as a speaker, as a free thinker, as a philosopher. Why didn't you go into politics, real politics? Why did you go into the police?
Yes, let me explain. I was deployed into the police, and when in 1995 the South African Police Service was formed out of 11 agencies, Homeland Agencies, and also forces from the liberation movements. I had in fact been already integrated into the National Intelligence Agency of our country. And from there, when there was a need to build the crime intelligence capability of the South African Police Service, and to, as a cadre at the time, play a role in the transformation of the South African Police Service. I was selected for that particular task and was part of a group of people, a core group of the leadership of the ANC's intelligence wing at the time, and then senior officers in the NIA, to move over, recruit a team of people and move over into the Crime Intelligence Division of the South African Police Service. So my role from the beginning and my mission was one of transformation, the one of creating a new South African Police Service and giving, I think, policy and practical and operational content to what, as a cadre, I understood to be the task of projecting the gains that we have made through our struggle, through building a democratic police service.
And so, what was the responsibility?
I was then selected. And so, if you're talking about joining, it is it's not that it's an individual decision with individual volition, but it's part of the cadre responsibility which I embraced at the time.
So if I understand you correctly, this was a continuation of a soldier following orders for a particular operation?
Yes, but also of a revolutionary who was given the leadership position I had at the time, who had to lead a cadreship of 20 people to and prepare them and lead them to go into the police with the purpose of transforming it.
Sure.
Yes.
So the reason why I ask that question in that way, Jeremy, is, and I'm sure you can hear where I'm going, was the priority, the weight of your consciousness in this decision that was made for you to be part of a new South African Police Service, was your priority to fulfill your mandate as a deployed soldier and revolutionary, or was it about going into the police service to fight, I suppose, criminality, as would be defined by an upcoming new dispensation? We'll go into that. But where did the weight of your priority lie? Was it in the mandate of your organizational directive, or was this a man who bought into the idea of an integrated, transformed law enforcement service?
It was both. I grew up in an organization where one of the clauses in the Freedom Charter involved the right to houses for safety, spoke about safety, security, and comfort. And I understood in that context safety and security to, in a democratic future, to be essential to secure the gains we made in the fight for our freedom, and to ensure that beyond just formal democracy, that our people can enjoy an environment in which the quality of that freedom is characterized by safety in the environments in which they live, and by security, and by particularly from crime and organized crime, which to me would fundamentally affect the quality of the freedom. And I, in the areas I grew up in, the Elton River, gangs affected my freedom of movement, my freedom of association, fundamentally I could not enjoy the benefits and my generations after me of that type of freedom, of going to facilities that came with new sports facilities, because they happened to be in another gangster area.
Yeah.
I happened to be in another. So you see, it was the effects on people's freedom was so fundamental, and as fundamental as the effect of apartheid in restricting those similar types of freedom. So it's a bit of both. So the police was an important institution in speaking to that demand in the Freedom Charter for safety and security, but to ensure that we safeguard and protect the quality of the freedom that we want. So like I said, it's very difficult to separate between the two.
Mm.
I am a revolutionary, and I did not die when I came into the police.
Yeah.
That type of consciousness.
And part of that whole process involved integration of former enemies. I mean, you had to now become colleagues and fellow crime fighters in a context where some of the so-called crimes that your now colleagues were fighting against were in fact the operations of yourself as a revolutionary, as an MK soldier. How did that work? How did that integration process work? What were the levels of mistrust, and how did you guys handle those kinds of issues?
Okay, let's just firstly say we were integrated into the heart of the security exam. The crime intelligence environment in which we went was the old security branch. And some of its residue practices and institutions and job descriptions were still there. For example, I explained in the book, I ironically at one stage became the Western Cape provincial head for internal security. I mean, you know what history that word is. So firstly, in the institutional environment, I was going at that stage with a mission to transform the very environment where I had a very direct relationship with, because they, you know, arrested me, charged me for terrorism, and I went to Robben Island.
Yeah.
So I was there with the same people who tortured me, the same people who had arrested me, and they were now working under my command in most cases. So those were the challenges that came with it. I had to, emotionally, whatever I subjectively felt about that in the interest of democracy and the influence of reconciliation, I had to just put up with it and live with it. And it's part of the challenges, you must understand. People don't change overnight, so me coming in at that point in time, found myself with some of the most basic petty forms of racism that one sometimes.
Yeah.
Some people wouldn't want to drive in the same car with you, because they definitely were not used to driving in the same car with their colleagues who were classified in the same way as you were. But one advantage we had is because they always only worked political intelligence.
Yeah.
They were wholly, wholly unequipped at the time to work as crime and ordinary crime. The intelligence service of the police now had to be thrust into a terrain that was entirely foreign to them. And that is where people like us, who came from the liberation movements, who had a very organic relationship with the community and were able to tap into information and networks in the community that could also be used directed against crime, we became the authoritative sources of the direction in which the new crime intelligence environment moved at that point in time. Because I'm sure none of the who were with us had any experience in this desert.
Yeah, we taught
them.
Let me bring that aspect into greater focus, Jeremy. Part of what you became was a police officer. In other words, somebody who fights against crime. And I would argue that some of those crimes would have been understood at a certain point in time of your life as part of the destabilization project of an illegitimate regime, right?
Yeah.
I mean, part of the strategy of the fight against apartheid was to make the South African government ungovernable. And part of that would have been to engage in what the apartheid regime called crime, but what the liberation movement would have called a strategy in the destabilization of that illegitimate government. And so my question becomes, how did you reconcile those ideas in your revolutionary mind? And how did you then become a fighter of certain people who may have been deemed to be criminal by a regime that you fought against through what they would have called criminal actions? Does my question make sense?
Yeah. Look, it was not a question. It was not a contradiction to me. Fighting apartheid in the way we did. Apartheid was organized crime at a grand scale.
Yeah.
Although it was also declared internationally as a crime against humanity, but in terms of various practices that went with it, if you think about sanctions busting and those things, it happened to organized crime routes to illegally get certain goods into the country. So, I mean, to me, it's an extension of the same thing. It's not a contradiction to me in life. Although there's a more political side to the previous form of the crime that one has said, but I didn't find anything irreconcilable about the two.
What did you understand a crime to be? In other words, was your understanding of crime limited to what the law says a crime is? Or did you understand crime to be a little more intricate in the South African context?
No, I did not. I understand it as basically in terms of the law. If people stole the land, as it happened, it is theft, grand scale. If people murdered people with impunity and tortured people, it is a crime, as much as it would be today. If there was abuse of power and corruption that came with that particular, it's a crime. Has it done assassinations by the police of comrades? It's a crime. It would have been a crime today. It's still a crime. So if one wants to look at it in a purely legal sense, whatever happened in our past in the world sport, there was entirely organized or criminal a politics of organized crime at a grand scale, with nearly whatever ideological motives they were at the time. And the apartheid regime, so I don't see things any different.
Yeah.
So I did not see any contradiction. I had no internal struggles about it. Like I said, you know, as much as apartheid affects the quality of our affected and try to repress us in our neighborhoods or where we live and affected the quality of our life and deprived us of our freedom of movement and expression and other freedoms, so do gangs, so do syndicates today. So I really don't see any distinction.
My guest is Jeremy. My guest is former Major General. Do we still call you Major General? I mean, just generally, or are you former Major General?
No, you can call me former Major General. That's not the issue. And the other thing is my. My matter is at HSBC level, and the outcome of that, we can finalize the outcome, will be now in November.
Yeah.
So it's in view of coming back.
Yeah.
And if that part, it will go all the way up to the highest level courts to be fought for me for us to get back because of
sure.
With the that's why what happened.
Jeremy Vieri is the author of a memoir, a police memoir called Into Dark Water, and very interesting issues that he has had to deal with in his career. And a really, really incisive mind, in my opinion, as far as how he has had to deal with some of what may seem to be contradictions in his career. And I'd love to take your calls. If you've had occasion to read Into Dark Water, please give us a call. I'd love to hear from you. If there's any questions that you might want to ask Jeremy, please give us a call. I'd love to hear from you. Part of what some people may say about your initiative, which was the creation of those anti-gang units that were informed precisely by your organic relationship with the community that understood how gangs operate, how at an organic level, not just at a, you know, at the level of the crime fighter sitting in an office far away from the realities of Elsie's River. You created these anti-gang units. And some may argue, Jeremy, that these gangs themselves were at some level part of the destabilization effect against apartheid. How do you respond to that?
No, I do not agree with it. Can I? Where I grew up, we were robbed by the same gangsters, despite what apartheid did to us. So it's, there wasn't even a Robin Hood kind of complex situation where we would benefit from whatever spoil we would get in areas outside of that. Our hard-earned income, our misery produced their spoils for out their existence. So, I mean, I don't want to, they have no claim to some romantic history of that. However, one phenomena might have started off like that, and that is what is today known as the numbers gangs, which has its origins.
Yes.
Similar criminal bandit group that operated in the Rand and East Rand areas of the same. Were called the Ninevites in particular, that later became the forerunners of the 28th and the 27th gangs and those things.
Yeah.
So that, and they expressed at the time their struggle and the action against mother mines and robbing mining sites and targeting the village community. They explained it in the political way, you know?
Mm.
And some of that little philosophy went into the way, even when they became prison gang, 28, 26, 27, they used to say in Afrikaans, slum, nothing better. So they politicized what had become, in their philosophy, a struggle against what they called the Mapuza or powers that be. But the methods and what was involved was still purely criminal. They killed the, and most of the time the victims of their crimes were the very communities that they claimed they were the forces that we were oppressing.
So,
I mean, no matter how you color whatever you say, you even take it down to the most common denomination of what your actions mean. This is criminal.
One of the things you said was that you taught some of your of the people who would then become your colleagues a way of policing that was fundamentally inspired by an organic knowledge of the communities in which they had to operate. And that ultimately became the drug fighting units, particularly in the Western Cape and so forth.
Okay, let me just draw a distinction here. When I was a station commander, I found that our communities at street committees where I worked, they had different structures. And I noticed that they challenged the powers of gangsters to secure their own immediate environment, okay? So they became a form of counter-mobilization. This is a long day, and even under apartheid it was like that, you know. I tapped into that reservoir of knowledge and experience and supported my approach to community policing when I was a station commander at some point in time, counter-mobilization against gangs, because gangs were becoming an alternative form of criminal governance.
Yeah.
And in the absence of formal governance or that. So they've grown to that under apartheid, you know. While the lot of policing resources were spent on the repressive and focusing on dealing with liberation movements.
Yeah.
Structures have grown unfitted for 40, 50 years. Some of these gangs go back to the 60s and the 70s and the number of gangs back to the late 1800s.
Sure.
How did these things, despite what was happening, a very repressive regime or security regime, survive and thrive and grow to the scale that they are now? So one of the things was, if we do not have the capacity through merely a securocratic approach or policing approach to deal with the matter, there's two tasks that we have. We have to regain the space that was lost by the community and challenge this criminal governance. So that was the purpose, popular mobilization against gangs that are clearly targeted. And that is what the approach I followed. It was not only about how do you constantly engage in conscientizing people who know about the threat more than what you do.
Yeah.
So your relationships would change and tap into their reservoir of experience and their knowledge of collective organization.
How did you keep that in check, though? So in other words, and my mind goes over to organizations like PAGID, for example. Who started out as organizations that were steeped in a certain morality, fighting against the burgeoning gangsterism and the stronghold that they were having on society. And your approach, your strategy seemed to perhaps, I don't know if PAGID itself was perhaps part of that process, but your strategy seems to be to have used the agency of organizations that are in community that were close perhaps to crime to, as you say, regain that space. How did you keep that in check? And what are your thoughts about PAGID, its beginnings, its evolution, and its current state?
Okay, the first thing on the first question is, if the community wanted to march and target a specific drug dealer or gang leader, or I was there with them. In other words, to protect them, to protect that mobilization.
Right.
I had police officers that were deployed at bonfires with street committees. I had people, when we go on our community patrols, where police officers and even senior officers set the example of being there with the community to protect the mobilization. So that is what we did over weekends. We did that. So that was the first thing. If we wanted the community to mobilize, we must be shown to be there to protect that and not leave them at the mercy of everybody on the streets. So, but it's that collaboration that took us to the level of regaining certain space, closing certain drug avenues in areas like we just played, in a way that would take us through a normal 10-year or 5-year or whatever long investigation, much more longer time through the courts.
Yeah.
We would then what popular action gave. Popular action closed it, but the control came. You know, we never had vigilante problems when we are there. So the lesson was, you must be there if the community mobilizes.
But what wasn't
then there? These other things won't happen.
Yeah. Wasn't there a sense of the emboldenment of vigilante groups because they had a sense that they had some sort of legitimacy and support from Major General Jeremy Viery? I mean, I'm thinking about the Stachy murder, right? Did you know about that as the police? Maybe that might be.
I was in intelligence back then.
Yeah.
I was stationed. But what I'm saying, where partnerships with communities and community mobilization together with the police is poor, vigilantism is rich. Okay? Where the police does not have this organic seatedness and relationship with community initiatives against crime, there, vigilantism rides. Because look, let's thrive. Let's explain it simply to you in this way.
Yeah.
We do not have enough police stations and enough police officers to cover the whole full expanse in every corner of South Africa and every street in every town.
Yeah.
We do not have them through mere visible posturing. So you need the multiplication of force levels that come with community mobilization and joint community patrols. And not only patrols, but joint anti-crime initiatives, whether it's dealing with juvenile crime at schools or whatever. You need that kind of support. You need the involvement of teachers. You need the involvement of the religious sector. That is a multiplying capability for multipliable force that you would never be able to replicate on your own at that moment.
Yeah.
So, but where that doesn't exist, you know, where there's not strong community organizations or in some areas in the more middle class environments, neighborhood watches or whatever associations they have, where there is not that joint focus, that alignment of anti-crime energy.
Yeah.
You fail. You have the room for vigilance. And then, you know, to tell you, this is not something that I did on my own. This thing is rooted in our Police Act. If you go to Section 18F, where that deals more with our relationship with the community, it says that we should engage in joint problem identification.
Yes.
And joint problem solving. Now, that is requires a very deep organic relationship with the community, not only to know what is going on, but also participate in finding a common solution.
Does that not
exercised by the police,
yeah,
we fail and we create the space for vigilantism.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not saying what I did was common throughout the Western Cape. I applied it as I understood it, community policing. I was, of course, had the energy that drove that comes from my revolutionary past and where I saw my cup. And I ensure that police officers who work with me that's not the same for other police stations.
Yeah.
The police officers in the Western Cape. So if you notice in areas where faggot emerged,
yeah,
it usually was quite strong, whether a shift of vigilantism happened. It's where policing was weak in these very areas that I was talking about.
Yeah, yeah. The creativity in the application of that particular act is absolutely commendable, and I think that we need more of that kind of policing. But as you now express, that where policing is not present enough and where leadership doesn't understand how to apply that law in the best possible way, I imagine that you can then have a conflation, a blurring of the lines between criminality and the enforcement of law, the creative enforcement of the law by police officers who might not understand that organic relationship as they should. And I imagine that you have been a victim of perhaps nefarious intents. I mean, the whole issue with MODAC, who accused you of seeking bribes, and I imagine taking occasion of the fact that you had this sort of organic relationship with the ground in order to enforce the law. I come back to the question that says, how do you police that? How do you watch the watchers? Because part of the big problem that we've been experiencing in South Africa is when our police officers succumb to the enticements of the criminal world, given the fact that sometimes they don't get remunerated and awarded and acknowledged as they ought to. How did you deal with it, Jeremy?
You see, listen, to me, being a police officer is a principled commitment. It's about serving something bigger than yourself and your pay packet. Now, whether it's here or in any part of the world, no matter what salary you earn, okay, if they want to corrupt you, then your interests are based on monetary compensation. They can outpay whatever the police might be able to offer. It's not only common here, it's all over the world. You get generals who get corrupted, who earn substantive salaries, as we've seen in our history so far. So, I mean, the argument that sometimes says, you know, people are paid poorly and therefore certain of these things happen, doesn't quite, it's not borne out in fact.
Yeah.
But at institution, the function of policing or the commitment to do that is a principled one that does not necessarily involve only the mere getting of a job. You must be prepared to sacrifice and serve beyond your personal even interest, even at the cost of your personal interest. Now, I mean, it's a hard thing, but I believe the advantage, and so do some of the comrades who came with them, as having come from that, being grounded in that type of principled way of thinking. Although some of us also went the other direction, but at least we have that advantage, and, you know, a lot of that kind of value-based kind of way to looking at the job, it's not prevalent generally in culture among police officers who join. I've seen a lot of them, you know, join because it's the last option to find another income rather than those factors. So
were you ever approached by criminal hierarchy to get you off the beaten track, as it were?
Never, you see. Let me tell you an interesting thing of all these accusations, you know, and see what you know, but I know there was media coverage of one chap who said he saw it in a dream and an angel came to him and said, I was at this meeting with politicians who were engaged as a TED and discussed how we're going to benefit from the process and being accused. And the irony is that, you know, all these accusations about who I allegedly work for, if you scratch deeper, you will discover that I was in teams that actually investigated those people and had many of them convicted. I mean, the old allegations around Narcissus and MODAC, I think, becomes quite a farce if you look at the fact that on the forefront of initiating the investigations in earlier years was myself and Colonel Daniel. The old other accusation that one other, the prophet that we call the guy who saw it in a vision, said that I put four outstands. The irony of the fact is, I was part of the initial investigation that put his uncle in prison at some point in time, but he died before the trial was finalized. And I am still yet to be a witness in a major trial of about 22 of them, including at New Leeds in particular.
Yeah.
And for racketeering, I'm the chief witness. So, I mean, a lot of these things, the logic don't even fly in the face of the rumors that get spread out, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The fight.
And I'm probably the leader of the 28-27 altogether, which is impossible even in their own culture to be.
Yeah. The fight that must be deliberated upon and a decision made, I think, next month, that you've been sort of engaged in with some of your former colleagues and some of the senior people in the service. Should you win? Should you be vindicated? Would you consider coming back to the service, or is this tickets for Jeremy Viery?
Of course, I will come back. My mission remains forever what it was. You know, and at Instowo, the reasons for which I came to policing still exists. Grants came, organized crime and the politics of organized crime is still a major threat, although it doesn't take it in a different form through grand scale corruption.
Jeremy, we've run out of time. Yeah. I wish I had so much more time to keep talking to you. I'd be interested to hear about your thoughts about the passing of Charles Kinnear. I'd be interested to hear, for example, about your thoughts about former cadres, former MK operatives demanding 4.5 million rands, house and medical benefits each because they were part of the MK. I'd be interested to hear some of your thoughts about that. I mean, just quickly, tell me about that. What do you think of those kinds of demands?
We've always fought for the people. We did not fought, consider our commitment to the struggle to be about advancing our personal wealth and welfare. And we did not look at that in terms of an individual.
So where's that coming from?
So I don't know. That is a culture that is foreign to what I know from the ANC. I was in 1983. I did not encounter that. I did not encounter that on Robben Island. That kind of acquisitiveness in an individual German acquisitive is something quite
Jeremy, I've got to stop. I'm so sorry. Jeremy Viery, the author of Into Dark Water, Police Memoir. Good luck to you, sir, and thank you very much for joining us.